back to New Comedy Radio, the Sabrina George interview with Dave Thompson from Zappa. What was the scene like then? Because talking about the quantity of clubs, we were doing a lot of travelling up and down the UK. Was it mainly around London in the early days?
It was travelling around UK and also abroad.
Right.
And I'm never happier than when I'm being paid to do stand-up abroad. I love it. And I've done stand-up in Sweden. I've been to Sweden 3 times. I did my best ever paid gig, actually, £1,500 for one gig. That was in Sweden. And I've done comedy in south of France to British audiences, expats mostly. I performed to the crew from Robert Maxwell's yacht, including his skipper.
When he was alive?
Shortly after he died. Apparently, Robert Maxwell, when he went to the toilet, he never used toilet paper, he'd use towels. And he'd have big, crisp, white, luxury, sort of thick pile, John Lewis standard or better, white towels. And when he had a poo, he wiped his bum with the towels and then just left them on the floor. And his servants had to collect the towels from him, from the toilet floor, after he'd wiped his bum with them. So anyway, I've done the south of France. I've performed even in Yugoslavia, before, when it was still Yugoslavia. And the Falkland Islands, which was amazing.
To troops.
To the troops, and also to the Falklanders in Port Stanley. And I've performed in America. I used to be Greg Proops' support act for a while in California, so I've done a lot of stand-up in California. And I've also performed in Budapest in Hungary as recently as a few months ago, and I've got another gig there coming up in a couple of weeks' time. I've performed in Warsaw and Prague twice. And I'm trying to think where else
Germany.
I've done it. Berlin. Done Berlin a few times. Where, sorry? I've done Diblau and Montag 3 times. And I've not only done stand-up, I've also done my pant-wetting act, which went down very well. That's where I get introduced as the world's top triangle player, Herr Punz. And I walk on with a bowler hat and formerly a false moustache, but now my real moustache, but with black eye mascara in it, and a sort of a bow tie and a triangle. And I go on with all the pomp as if I'm some great impresario.
Wearing a suit?
Smart clothes. And I hold the triangle as if I'm going to play it. And if it's high production values, it's an accordionist. And if there's low production values, it's a CD, playing sort of German umpire type music. And I stand there sort of holding the donger of the triangle, just sort of like ready to dong the triangle, but keep missing my cue. It's an old cliche. And then get a bit nervous, and then with the help of a pant wetting device, I wet my pants, not with wee-wee, but with water. It's a modified hydration thing for cyclists, which is on my back and underneath my clothes. I wet my pants, and then my wife, who's young and Hungarian, comes out wearing a PVC nurse's outfit and puts a sort of a hospital curtain type thing in front of me, which she hangs over my neck. It's actually a modified shower curtain. It looks green, so it looks like one of those hospital curtains. And she then changes my trousers and pants, and the slapstick arises from her trying to change my trousers and pants and me sort of like trying to cover up as though nothing's gone wrong and holding
the
triangle.
So the screen only goes up to your waist?
Okay. It hangs around my neck and just goes up to my waist. And she changes my trousers and pants, puts an identical pair of trousers on, takes the screen off and goes off, and then I hit the triangle on cue, bow in a self-important, precious way and walk off. It's not exactly a laugh a second, but people in Europe love that more slightly whimsical sort of comedy, and the Germans just leapt it up. They loved it and they asked us back. I also did it at Tim Clark's Stag Night. It went very well there as well. We were on in between the strippers, but the Germans asked us back, so I went back and I did my stand-up, and then later in the show we did the Herr Punzact. And this time we went out and I did my Naughty the Clown act, which is another one of my sort of experimental visual trying to get into the European market cabaret acts. And the Germans are supposed to be very, very efficient, but the sound man wasn't at the Die Blaue Montag that night, because we had a very simple sound cue with a CD, and we went through it with them at the technical run-through, because they're all very efficient about you've got to be there at 4 in the afternoon to go through your technical run-through, even if all you do is hold a microphone and talk into it, which we did. We turned out, we did the technical run-through, told him when to turn the CD on, when to cut it, and then when it actually came to the performance in front of over 300 Germans, he played the CD when it was supposed to be not played, and then didn't play it when it was supposed to be played, and totally ruined our act, completely sabotaged our act, and haven't been back since.
And it's difficult there because you can't leave the stage to go down to the sound check. You've got to go right round the back and right round the whole outside of the building to get on the sound. I did the same thing. They called me 3 o'clock the sound checks. I think I went on to 11 o'clock at night, and I'm stuck in that bloody building hours.
Oh yeah.
Oh, it was a strange gig. Because I know about equipment, and there's all the stuff I could do.
Yeah.
Other than sit on there, but there's no way you can access technology when you're on stage.
No.
You're stuck.
Yeah.
Some places you can just yell at people, go to the side of the stage and fix it that way, right?
Well, it was all too late anyway, you know, it was a short act, and it was a silent visual act, and it was just totally ruined by the sound man. But, I've done stand-up in, I'm trying to remember the places now.
So, just to go back to this, what do you do to prepare for going to, you know, if you go to Budapest or something? I mean, I know your wife's from Hungary, but how do you prepare for that particular audience? Do you change your material? Do you do a bit of research?
Well, it largely depends on whether it's an expat audience or not, because often somewhere in, you know, Prague, for example, it was an English-speaking audience, mostly English people. I was working in Switzerland a couple of weeks ago. It was mostly English people in the audience. So in that way, it's often not that different from performing in Britain. In fact, it can be even more like it, because you don't get any tourists in. The thing that you've all got in common is that you're from Britain. Whereas in Britain, you haven't got that in common necessarily. And you don't feel yourself, oh, we're all the same because we're English and we're in a foreign land. But I always try and go earlier if I can, so I can sort of be in the place and absorb it and get some ideas for one-liners. So, for example, when I was in Dubai, I said, it's lovely to be in Dubai. It reminds me very much of Los Angeles, although with a slightly different take on Islam. When I was in the Falkland Islands, I used to say to the troops, we'd have to be flown around by Chinook helicopter, and you have to wear a special immersion suit, rubber suit, before you're allowed in there, because you fly over water between East Falkland and West Falkland, and if you ditch, you'd be dead within a couple of minutes unless you've got one of these special immersion seats. Yeah. And I said there, you know, flying by Chinook, which has got a bit of an accident record, and I said, when you get in the Chinook, they actually make you put the body bag on before you get on the aircraft. And there's little things like that, so that you get a laugh because you're making a joke which is obviously about the place you're in, and it couldn't be anywhere else. Exactly.
Yeah.
Although sometimes you can transpose it and keep it. Like, for example, now I do I went to Los Angeles. If you haven't been to Los Angeles, it's a bit like Dubai, but with a slightly different take on Islam. So that came out of going to Dubai and doing a gig, which is another reason I like travelling, is because it feeds you material, you know, you get ideas for jokes. But I'll do that, and then try and get anything I can about the place. There's also certain jokes which you can just make it seem like it's from that place, but it's from anywhere. So, for example, almost any town in Britain is going to have a pretty bad one-way system, and it's also probably going to have some sort of water course, whether it's a river or a stream or the sea. So you could do a joke about the, you know, the river or whatever, and make it seem like it's actually peculiar to that place, but in fact it's done anywhere in any town. I think the only town without a water course in Britain is Milton Keynes, and that's got a canal. That's it really. And otherwise my jokes do tend to be they travel very well. Because I do one-liners, I'm not sort of talking about travelling on the tube or, you know, how crap the actors are on EastEnders or, you know, anything like that. So they do tend to be, if people understand English, they'll probably understand the jokes. Like, I've done a lot of work in Holland, and I hardly have to change the set at all for it to work in Holland, because if the Dutch, you know, they understand English very well, and so therefore they get all the jokes.
But what about some places where your audience is not going to be expats, it's going to be indigenous people, wherever it might be?
Yeah, well, they do. They, if they understand English, they'll get the jokes.
Do you like bring ahead and find out what kind of audience is and go, okay, they don't really speak English at all, well,
yeah, but it's not very often they book an English stand-up to do a place where they don't speak English.
So. Well, but Blanc Water did that with me. I mean, I speak a modicum of German, so I just didn't punch fans in German anyway. But a lot of comics were going over and they didn't realise they were the only English-speaking actor.
Yeah, yeah.
And most of the audience, a lot of them were East Germans, who didn't speak English really at all. Not to a very high degree.
Right.
So a lot of them were completely fazed by that.
Yeah.
Wolfoot went to do very well. It seemed to be so nuts.
Yeah.
Stuff doesn't necessarily make sense.
No, well, when I went there the first time, the bloke came on, he said, that was very good. He said, you adhere to the 5 rules for doing comedy in Germany. And I think those are, number one, you start in German. And I speak a bit of German too, so that was okay. Number two, not word plays, because word plays don't transpose well. Number three, not too many one-liners. And number four, you were visually funny. I forget number 5.
You were funny.
You didn't mention the war.
Exactly.
Sorry, I'm okay, thanks.
So when you went to...
Yeah, I was on a someone trying to sell the Big Issue, but I gave all my change to the last homeless person, and I'm not quite so saintly that I'm going to give a note.
So you do a bit of research. You do actually think that that's important to translate, or not translate, but find something that's going to connect with whatever audience you're going to when you get there.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, obviously, one wants to do as well as one can at the job, and that means sort of trying to find out what the audience is, because audiences vary so much. I mean, in Britain they vary a lot, and it's also not just the sort of person in the audience, but it's the actual setup. Because I think that you could have a man, put him in an art centre audience with his wife, and he'll probably be a great audience, and he'll laugh, and he'll get the subtle jokes. Take that man, put him in a stag party in a big club, and turn the clock back a few hours, so it's, you know, 12 o'clock instead of 8 o'clock, and he will be a totally different audience.
Yeah,
he'll be a monster, whereas he would have been a lamb in the first audience.
Yeah,
so the context in which you're performing is enormous. I mean, stand-up comedy is a very sensitive medium, and that's why when people come up to you after a show and say, oh, you know, we thought you were brilliant, we'd love you to do our birthday party, the reaction is to name a price that's so high they're going to say no thanks.
Or it's worth you committing suicide.
Yeah, or it's worth having a very undignified experience.
Nailed it through your eyes. Because that was the first time I met you. I went to, before I started stand-up, when I was with someone, and I can't remember, and I was with someone else who's actually started doing stand-up. We went to Fortnightly Club, and you gave us a lift home, and you were giving us a very serious conversation about how you had to have some horrifically low, hard material to deal with the stag parties and the 21st parties and the drunken hordes.
Yeah.
And I remember feeling completely deflated and going, I don't want to do comedy anymore because of that. And so, like, I talked to a couple of mates afterwards and they just said, well, that's just the path, of course. But I remember you were really serious that this actually had to be an important part of the comedian's life.
Well, it is in a way. I mean, I don't know when that was, but certainly I think now, in terms of stand-up, most of the market is the beer halls, isn't it? Beer halls full of stag nights and office parties where you've got 20 people from the office all going out on Friday night, and it could be karaoke, it could be 10-pin bowling, it could be, you know, a boat up and down the River Thames. And then the person who's organising it likes comedy, so they decide it's going to be a comedy club. And they're all sitting on Viking seating, facing each other, jugs of beer on the table, and you know, a man in the audience is trying to impress the girl from the copy photocopy room, and this is his only chance to have a social time with her. And you know, if he can try and impress her and make her realise how funny he is by shouting abuse at the comedian, then he will. But it's not really about listening to a bloke doing jokes. It's about, as they say, crowd control, isn't it?
I would agree. So the next bit of your career is the infamous Teletubbies. Tell us about that. How did you get that gig?
Well, I got it as a result. Stand-up comedy is the royal road to all sorts of other opportunities. And I got the job on the Teletubbies because from doing stand-up comedy, I met Harry Hill and worked with him and became friends with Harry Hill. When he had his first TV series, it was a series of 10-minute shorts for BBC Two called Harry Hill's Fruit Fancies. And he used me in various roles in the show, one of which was playing an Egyptian mummy. And the costume involved me having the sort of bandages sewn over my face, actually sort of sewn on, so that they didn't sort of fall off my face. And people used to say to me, you know, gosh, don't you feel claustrophobic, because you can't come out of there until we cut you out, you know. And I used to say, no, I loved it. I think I'm sort of, part of me is a bit autistic or Asperger's or something, but I actually love, you know, feel quite content and contained when I'm inside a costume like that with the head on. And
so
I didn't
just have the slits for eyes.
Tiny little weenie slits for eyes between the bandages, yeah, but I couldn't come out until,
because
I had bandaged hands, so I couldn't actually take myself out, and it probably wasn't fireproofed as well, so if it had caught fire, I probably would have been wearing real bandages afterwards. But I liked it, and a bloke who worked on that programme got a job working for Ragdoll, who was the company who made the Teletubbies, and he remembered me, and he asked me if I'd audition for the part of Tinky Winky. And at the time, we didn't know it was going to be like that. He said, you know, it's this kids' TV programme, you have to wear a full costume. Would you like to come for the audition? And I said, all right, when is it? He said, it's in the Welsh Centre at King's Cross on Friday morning at 10 o'clock, I think it was. And I said, well, I'm not going to come at 10 because I'm doing a gig in Bristol on Friday evening and working the night before, and I don't want to get up that early, you know. He said, well, come when you can. And I presumed it was going to be like most of the auditions one went to, which is TV commercial auditions at that time, where you get, you're in and out, like the dentist surgery. And he said, it's an all-day workshop audition. And I said, well, I can't do it all day. I want to beat the rush hour getting out onto the M4 on a Friday afternoon to get to Bristol. So he said, well, come for as long as you can. So anyway, I had to produce, had to prepare for the audition, had to prepare a 3-minute piece about childhood and a 3-minute piece for children under 5, and also be prepared to do workshop improvisation. And I didn't have time to prepare it, because I was busy doing stand-up gigs. It was quite common to be working, you know, 6 or 7 nights a week at the time. I mean, you know, sometimes I'd do 21 nights consecutively, often with more than one gig, you know, in one evening. And it was like that, you know, there was just so much work around. So I hadn't prepared anything, so I thought, well, I'll prepare myself on the tube. And I ended up being later than I meant to be, and there was a tube delay. And on the tube, it was absolutely packed. It was like standing room only, packed in like sardines. So there was hardly any way I could prepare, because I couldn't get any bits of paper out. So I just thought, I know, there was a bit of a stand-up routine, which was about going on holiday in France. So what I did, I started by saying, when I was a child, I went on holiday to France, and then did the routine about France, hoping they wouldn't notice that it was actually about France and not about childhood. And I just thought, I'll improvise the bit about for the under 5-year-olds. And I got there so late, I think I was nearly an hour late for the audition. I turned up outside the Welsh Centre in King's Cross, and I just thought, well, it's pointless going in, because who's going to give a job to someone who's an hour late for the audition? You know, it's not really a good sign, is it? And I thought, well, hang on now, I've come all this way, I might as well go in and do it, because otherwise I will have wasted my time. So I went in, very nearly didn't go in, but I went in, and at the time I used to do a routine where at the end of my act I'd take my clothes off and reveal a red light for a leotard and tights, and I'd do a pastiche of postmodern dance. And I had the leotard and tights with me, so when I had my when my turn came up for the audition bit, I just put the leotard and tights on and rolled across the floor into the middle of the floor, and then sort of said, "Hello, children, I'm a seed," and sort of got into the embryonic position and said, "I'm a seed, but as the sun shines on me and the rain falls on me, I grow into a tree," and I grew into a tree, and it was a sort of, you know, cliche thing, taking the piss out of that, but they loved it, they thought it was great. And then I did the stand-up bit, and then I did the workshop bit for a while, and then left, and I got asked back, and apparently they auditioned, I think it was 600 people for the part of Tinky Winky, and I got the part.
What was the second audition?
Oh, we had lots of recalls where we had to do various group workshop stuff, and they narrowed it down, and we had to sort of do things where we had heads on, you know, that you couldn't see, and all that sort of stuff. I mean, they didn't just go for what they call skin actors, because broadly speaking, the Teletubbies, no, it's skin acting, or it's what they call, you know, a skin role. But they purposely didn't ask any... It's when people play, they wear a big costume, so, you know, people wearing gorilla costumes or monkey costumes or... You know, in Lord of the Rings, when they wear those strange creature costumes, whatever, that's skin acting. And they didn't get skin actors. They didn't want skin actors. They actually wanted people who had a certain quality that they could then take to the roles of the Teletubbies. And, yeah, I got the part.
When did you know it was as big as it was? It is.
Well, we had an inkling it was going to be huge when we were actually working on it. We had a sort of a euphoric feeling that we were sort of like creating the sort of like the Beatles of the for the under fives in, for the sort of television type audience, not rather than music. We did have a feeling that we were making something that was going to be huge, and you know, it turned out that it was huge, partly because of the meticulousness of Anne Wood, who's the woman who sort of created it and owns the company Ragdoll that made it, and they were so thorough in their preparations that they knew it was going to be a success. What they did was they funded various creches or nurseries for some very young children all over the British Isles, including Northern Ireland, and in return for providing free creche or nursery facilities for very young children, what they do is they would show them preview videotapes and film the kids. They'd have a camera on top of the telly filming the children's reactions to what they were showing. And in the meetings that I used to go to at the time, we'd watch these tapes of children, and you'd see all these little tiny children sitting around a television set, and they'd be watching a tape of some programme they'd made, and then after a while, like, one of the kids might wander off, or two or three of them would wander off, or all of them would lose interest. And all the Teletubbies programmes were shown to all these kids in all these creches all over the British Isles. And if one of the tapes engaged the kids for the whole time and none of the kids wandered off, in every creche all around Britain, in, you know, every socio-economic category, they knew that when that was broadcast on telly, it would connect with the kids and keep them connected till the end of the programme. So they knew it was going to work before it was ever aired.
Yeah.
And they were right, because the Teletubbies is huge in Iran, it's huge in Indonesia, China.
Extraordinary, isn't it? That's extraordinary. So how much involvement did you have in creating not only the character of Tinky Winky, but also the material? Did you get involved with ideas?
A bit.
Not much.
I was told by Anne Wood that she wanted me to write for it, and I did write a couple of scripts for it, but she said, "I like what you're doing, but I can't actually use this." And then before I got any further with it, I got fired, so it didn't go any further.
How did you get fired?
At the end of the first, it's not filmed in the winter because it's filmed on location, or it was, it's not filmed anymore, but it was made on a farm a few miles south of Stratford-on-Avon, and because of that it wasn't made in the winter, and we started working on it in January. It was a while before we actually got to filming. I don't think we actually started filming it properly till sort of late May, June, but We started working on it in the January, and they pleaded poverty, and they paid us it was about £600 a week with unlimited overtime, unlimited unpaid overtime, and they said if it works and it takes off, we'll reward you, but this is all we can afford to pay you at the moment. and we worked really hard with unlimited overtime all the way through the summer until the 1st of November. And on the 1st of November, they were going to have a wrap party, which is the TV and film lingo for end of filming party. And they were also going to show the first rough edit of the first programme. And just before that party, I got given a letter telling me I was fired. And what I should have done, I now realise what I should have done, is gone to the party and kicked up the biggest fuss anyone kicked up. But I didn't, because of the way I was brought up, which I was brought up basically with a sort of way that it's a weakness to show any sort of emotion in public. Which is odd, really, considering I chose to be a performer. which is all about showing emotion in public. But that was the way I was brought up. And so when I got the letter, I got in the car. I said goodbye to a couple of people who I was near. I got in the car and I drove off. And I haven't really spoken to them since.
And why do you think you got fired?
Well, the letter said that my interpretation of the role had not been accepted. And that they had no problem with my commitment or my energy or anything like that, but they said my interpretation of the role had not been accepted.
Even though
everything I was doing, they were saying it was fine and patting me on the back and saying carry on doing what you're doing, what you're doing is great. And then suddenly it wasn't great. It was all a bit strange. I was told lies, and I think the truth of it is, as much as I can understand it myself, I was warned before I started working there by someone who had knew someone who'd worked for Ragdoll and Anworth before, and they said that there is a culture of people walking into the office, if they worked in the office, walking in the office and being told, have your desk cleared by midday, you're out. And that people did tend to get sort of chewed up and spat out. And that's what happened to me, and it happened to a lot of other people. There was a sort of a Stalinist type purge at the time, and loads of other people got fired. The designer of the Teletubbies was Bob Burke, who designed Monty Python's Flying Circus, and he was a part owner in the company, and he got fired. And funnily enough, I was out sailing last weekend in the Thames Estuary off the Kent coast, and he sailed past on his boat. We actually sailed past each other. But that I think that something happened that I went from Anwood thinking I was great to Anwood deciding that I had to be fired. Yeah. And I still don't really understand. And I don't want to say anything bad about Anwood. If it hadn't been for her, I wouldn't have been given the job. So I don't want to badmouth her.
So what happened then? Presumably for 11 months you couldn't do any gigs.
No, I did work. I kept doing the stand-up. It could have been tempting to... when I signed the contract to do the Teletubbies, it was worth over £100,000. And it would have been tempting to have sort of said, right, you know, bugger the stand-up. This is what I'm doing now. But I didn't, because I always loved doing stand-up. And what I used to do was I used to do stand-up at weekends. So we'd work Monday to Friday, and I'd often get off the set on the Friday and quickly have to drive somewhere and work on the Friday night, and then on the Sunday night I'd do a gig somewhere and then drive straight to the hotel near the location to be up at 6 in the morning on Monday to do the filming. And I also was the regular compere at a comedy club in Bath on Tuesday evenings, which was every other Tuesday. And what I'd do then is I'd be up at 6 in the morning on the Tuesday morning, do a day's filming, and then run out, have a quick shower, because we used to get very hot in the costumes and sweaty, have a shower, get in the car and drive 80 miles to Bath, compared to an audience who were regular, so therefore I'd have to have new stuff, and then leave the club at about sort of 11:45 midnight, drive 80 odd miles back to the hotel, get in bed by about 2:30, and then be up again at 6 in the morning. And I was deliriously happy and I loved it. Because when you're doing something that you actually feel is the reason that you were put on the planet, you get energy, you know, you love it, you're driven, it's a great feeling.
Yeah, tiredness has a different dimension.
Mm.
So then you, because you sort of went to the press about what had happened, or the press came to you.
They came to me, yeah. I got fired on the 1st of November in 1996, and the show wasn't aired until Easter Monday. Or Easter Sunday, 1997. and it became a huge hit, a phenomenon. There was an enormous press interest, and Ragdoll kept a policy of total secrecy and no information given to the press. Everybody who worked for the company was banned from talking to the press on pain of being fired. And so there was this sort of huge vacuum. Everybody wanted a Teletubbies story, but there was no Teletubbies story. It was a huge vacuum. And I had a phone call from a friend of Steve Punt, of Dennis, Punt and Dennis, from a journalist, and she said, "I'm a friend of Steve Punt's, and he gave me your phone number. I hope you don't mind me phoning, but I'm a journalist on The Independent on Sunday, and I understand that you're a Teletubby. I was wondering whether you talked to me about it." I said, "Well, I used to be. I'm not anymore. I got sacked." And she said, "Oh, I didn't know that." I said, "Yes." And I told her, I gave her a brief interview over the telephone. And I then went off to do stand-up comedy in some festival that was going on in Devon. And I remember because John Otway was on as well. And I sort of got chatting to him quite a few times and got to know him a little bit. And then on the Sunday morning, I was walking past him between the tent and the showers, and John Otway said, "Oh, I read that thing in The Independent on Sunday about you." I said, "Oh, you know, good, good," and I didn't read it myself. And then
it was a little byline somewhere.
Well, it was just a small little article on The Independent on Sunday, but all the other newspapers read it, and from that, they created front page headline news on the Monday. So all the tabloids on the Monday had just huge, great big thing. Tinky Winky's being fired. And they treated it, as they often do in the press, as if it had just happened, even though I told The Independent on Sunday the truth, which was that it had happened months before. But it was treated as if the bloke playing Tinky Winky has just been given the sack. And there was the journalists were trying to get hold of me, and they couldn't because I was in a field in Devon. It was before everyone had a mobile phone, and apparently I'd had journalists camped out all night outside my front door of my flat in Lambeth Walk in London, and they were interviewing my neighbours. You know, there were photographs of my neighbours and interviews of my neighbours in the absence of being able to talk to me. And I remember I came out of my tent or something on the Monday morning, and my friend Charmian Hughes, another comedian, she said, "Dave, your life has changed, your life has changed." And she was waving this copy of The Sun at me. And there was you know, all this stuff about Tinky Winky has been fired, and quotes from 10 Downing Street, and quotes from all sorts of celebrities. And I phoned my agent, and they said, "Our switchboard has been jammed all day. The Sun will pay you £2,000 just to talk to them first before anyone else. You know, get yourself out of Devon and get to London quick." So I did, and I was sort of like the most famous man in Britain. I had two phone landlines in my flat, and both landlines were phoning non-stop. Both of them were just ringing all the time. And I remember the Paul Ross show, which was a sort of like the talk show on Friday evenings at the time on ITV. They phoned. And they said, "You know, we want you to be on the show this Friday evening." And I said, "Well, what's the money?" And they offered some sort of money. And by then, I knew, because I'd had enough experience of it, that I could get more. So I just laughed and put the phone down. And within a second of putting the phone down, it was ringing again. And I picked it up, and it was them, and they were saying, "Okay, how much do you want?" And I was on, you know, interviewed on sort of every TV show and everything. Someone,
and you're basically saying the same story to everyone.
Yeah, yeah. I was just being honest, you know.
Didn't like me.
Yeah, I don't know why. Yeah.
Real juicy tidbits.
There was nothing.
Yeah.
And at the time, I'd also been doing The Greatest Show on Legs with Malcolm Hardy, which was doing the naked balloon dance. And we'd recently done that in a place in Bath. And it was two adults, you know, an adult audience. And I think it was Malcolm. He always denied it, but I'm pretty sure it was Malcolm. Sold the photographs of us doing the naked balloon dance for £3,000 to the Daily Mail. And they were sort of presenting it as, "Oh, this actor, whilst he was being Tinky Winky in a kid's, he was doing naked balloon dancing." And so that was sort of, you know, huge, great big photographs of that in all the newspapers. And then someone said to me, "You should go to Max Clifford." And I said, "Well, why? You know, I don't want to you know, I didn't even ask for any of this publicity. And then, on the Wednesday evening, night, in fact, at about 12:30 at night, I had a phone call, and it was somebody from Ragdoll, the company that made the Teletubbies, and this man said, "Hello, I'm the press officer from Ragdoll, and I'm giving you a friendly warning, but there's a lot of money riding to do a sex scandal on you." And then he put the phone down. So that was the first I've heard from Ragdoll since they sort of paid me off at the end of doing it, when they gave me the contracted money. The contract was that if anyone got sacked, they had to pay you the next 2 months' money, which they did. So I thought, well, that's odd, you know, there's no sex scandal to be had. What are they phoning me up for, saying there's a lot of money riding to do a sex scandal on you? But I realised that there probably was going to be something in that, even though I didn't have anything to hide, somebody was going to come out, you know, and say, well, when we were students, I slept with him and he's got a tiny winkle or, you know, whatever. And I thought, well, as someone's already made 3,000 quid from selling the picture to the Daily Mail of me doing the naked balloon dance, and I'm not making any money out of this, I might as well, you know, try and do something and take control of it. So I phoned Max Clifford, and there was a thing in the News of the World on the following Sunday, but I was offered a lot of money. I was offered over £50,000 to talk about the other Teletubbies or anybody working at Ragdoll, which I didn't do because I've got my integrity, and I certainly wasn't going to start giving anyone else's secrets away. So I turned down the 50,000 quid and went for a lot less money.
What was the terrible scandalous story that they didn't or did break to the press?
It was the headline was, "I was a kinky winky on the Teletubby table." And I sort of admitted to smoking marijuana and making love to my beautiful blonde girlfriend on the set of the Teletubbies.
So if anything, adding to your whole stand-up career, not detracting at all.
Well, that's as far as I'd ever want to go, really, in that sort of sleaze thing. But I sort of, in many ways, had no choice, because if I hadn't done it, someone else would have done it, and they'd have got the money, and they'd have said maybe something very horrible about me. So yeah. I thought the best thing to do was to keep it, you know, sort of as clean as I possibly could.
Be ahead of the game.
Yeah.
Having sex with your girlfriend, you know, around your work environment is not that scandalous, really.
Not really, no.
Let's take a break at that point. The part two.
Okay. I think I might have a beer now because.